that there will be a series of events. We're going to do a similar event on weddings in the spring, and hope that you'll encourage others. We hope that as this becomes an annual event, that we'll see many of our students coming, and so we appreciate you. One of the things we're obviously working through is the schedule for today. We're trying to keep this as close to a half a day as possible, because we know many of you have classes that you can't miss, and so we'll keep the schedule moving, and I'll give you another break here in a little bit. I want to take a moment, though, just to share my appreciation to these who have come. Dr. Bill Cottrell and Dr. Ken Magnuson are both going to be sharing with us now. Dr. Bill Cottrell has a unique perspective for us today, because he is not only a medical doctor, but also our Gaines Professor of Christian Ministry and the director of our Gaines Center for Christian Family Ministry. A graduate then of not only the UK College of Medicine, but also Dallas Theological Seminary. So he's going to come and share issues from both perspectives, that of in the area of grief and death, not only from the perspective of a medical doctor, but also that of a theologian. He has pastoral experience in Mesquite, Texas, and also, of course, private practice. And then I know a job that he's also very proud of. He's also the medical director for the Women's Choice Pregnancy Resource Center here in our area. So we're so thankful Dr. Cottrell could come. So Bill, you come share with us.
Thanks, John. Good morning. I am delighted to be here. The part of the talk I heard was so incredibly practical. I wish I'd had it while I was in seminary before I began to pastor. So many practical things. In Texas, where I performed my first funeral service, I didn't realize that until the pastor at the head of the casket took his flower off and put it on the casket, nothing else happened. So I'm standing there feeling very proud of myself, and everyone else is sitting and looking at me. But fortunately, the funeral director, who knew the rules, came over in a very dignified fashion, like he did it all the time, unhooked my little flower, put it on, and then everything started. And I learned quickly from that. But I am grateful to those in my crisis class. Just this past week, I assigned as part of their final exam to go and visit one of the funeral homes and get behind-the-scenes tours and talk to the directors and learn how to make this ceremony dignified and appropriate and a help to those who are grieving. So I commend those who have arranged this, and I hope you will take advantage of this opportunity to sort of demystify the process and make you feel more comfortable for you to be able to minister in people's times of grief. You got to get over some stuff, and that means some exposure. Let me pass on to you the first and perhaps only bit of advice I got from seminary in this area. I think it was the first week of classes when they told me, always be ready to pray, to preach, or preside over a funeral. And of course, I laughed and smiled. But I went to attend the funeral of one of our church members, and the pastor that was supposed to preside didn't show. So I was invited to preside with that much warning. So I encourage you to be ready. And if you've got Psalm 23 and John 14 kind of in your pocket, you can roll if you have to. All right? So my task from the medical standpoint is to look at death and dying and then the normal grief response and what an abnormal grief response looks like. And that's not just as you minister, but we're all going to go through this eventually, should the Lord tarry. And I put these on there as a reminder that God is sovereign. There is a time to give birth. There is a time to die. And while as one who's involved in the crisis pregnancy ministry, we often use Psalm 139 as excitement over the fearfully and wonderfully made and God weaving in the womb, but I think it's also important to know that the days are ordained. That means there is a start and there is a finish for all of us. And I think that's important, because one of my take-home points for you is dying is not contagious. Death is not contagious. What you need to be able to do is get in there as a presence and be close to people and be able to talk about these issues and help them walk through it without fear. Some of the most hurtful things I've seen done by ministerial staff is a fear of the dying, and then even a fear to get close to those who are grieving. So I'm going to encourage you that this is an awesome, sacred privilege to participate in someone's walk through this valley, both the dying and then the survivors. So let's go ahead and ask the question, how do we as human beings die? I don't like to lecture, I like interaction, those of you that have me, so for those making the tape, I'll try to repeat the really clever things you say. Why do we die? How do we die? Heart stops, that's one of the big ways, and it's a good way. You know, if you're, it has to do with oxygen to the key tissues. And one of the ways that happens is the heart stops beating. Now, that can happen in an immediate event. As many of you know who've had me, I've had open heart surgery twice where they've had to stop the heart to fix the valve and hopefully start it up again. And in fact, it did start up again. But oxygen to vital organs is key, and the heart's what circulates that. So anything that destroys one or the other or starts to throw the body chemistry off so that the heart no longer beats effectively, which can be liver disease and kidney disease and all those sorts of things. And if you have been with someone who's dying, and in particular, if you've been with a Christian who is dying, it is a remarkable sacred moment. And I would encourage you to not be afraid of that, but to really invest yourself to learning how that process goes. Because I am convinced that the Lord is present in those circumstances in ways that are really hard to articulate. Many people are afraid of dying because they're afraid of pain. And let me suggest to you that at the state of the art in this country, pain is rarely uncontrollable, rarely. In fact, there are specialists in pain management, so that the process of death is often a very peaceful one. In fact, if your heart stops beating, were that to happen to me right now, in a matter of seconds, the oxygen in my brain would cease, and I would pass out, basically. How many of you have passed out? You've obviously all woken up again. But what do you remember about that experience? Nothing. It's very peaceful. The brain stops working, and off you go. Now, if that's the last time that your heart beats, then you wake up to an eternity with the Lord. Not a bad deal. But one thing to encourage people is that we can make them comfortable. Yes, there are some ethical issues about how much comfort medicine we can give because there are some risks of using it. But for the one who is terminally ill, and that's how I want you to think pastorally, because this life-threatening event may be a spiral that starts with this and then slowly over time it goes, or it may be the catastrophic failure, the gunshot, the car wreck, or whatever, and the life threat is immediate. But as I tell the crisis class, what happens in the emergency room when a young person is in a major wreck or has an accident is we have to assume you're still there. So we will do everything we can to restore your beating heart and circulation. And it's only some days later that we can figure out what's happening with brain waves. And that sometimes is when the pastoral staff is invited in to help with some very difficult decision making. Do we continue with the supportive care? Do we stop things and withdraw treatment? You never stop caring, but I would submit to you there are some times where aggressive therapy is not indicated anymore. And so as we look at the event and the process, you have to get a handle on, is this reversible, in which case it's curative, or is it irreversible? Death is inevitable. And then once you know that, and believe me, pastoral folks in hospitals, if you've got a good relationship with the hospital staff, you are just a huge asset to the medical team, and hopefully you see them as an asset to you in terms of medical care, not only to the injured person or the ill person, but to the family. Coordinated care is huge. Nurses will let you go places they won't let anybody else go because you say, well, I'm their pastor. You'll come into intensive care units when it's not visiting hours. They will tell you things that they might not tell others, sometimes robed in language that, you know, is legally safe, but they will let you know what's happening. And that is a great opportunity for you to get on board and understand, are we going full court press for cure, or do we realize cure is not possible? We're making comfortable, we're making plans, we're given time for this person to, if conscious, to sort of put their things together and get their accounts settled and talk to those they love. There was a time when we didn't tell patients that they were dying 20, 30 years ago. That's terrible. That's patronizing. I want to know. And most people do. Now, there are ways to tell them gently. I mean, you don't have to just smack them over the head, but they ought to have the right to ask or give forgiveness, to get their accounts squared, to make things right with the Lord. And so I am of the school that we talk openly about legitimate prognosis. There are still some things we can do, but frankly, it doesn't look good. I think that's a fair statement. Now, in the 60s, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross wrote a book which is now a classic, and the title is On Death and Dying. I would encourage you, because none of the stuff since then has done much to improve on it. What she did was interview dying people. What precious truth we can learn from those who know. And as one who was facing that kind of surgery where there's certainly that opportunity, you really do think more clearly then about what life is worth and what are important, and some other things really start to fade. It is a huge opportunity, if you are sitting with the dying, to get an understanding of what their life meant and what things were important, and you can learn much from that. But these sort of stages are not only generally the case, and it's a lot like a roadmap that you have to go through them in order or a predictable order, but we also see this in lots of mental issues, mental areas of struggle. Denial happens to be one of my favorite stages. It's something I'm good at. That can't be so. Can't be true. Not true. And that's pretty normal. And then moves the anger, and you know, as Dr. Ewert mentioned, it's really common for them to be mad at anybody, but in particular, the God who let this happen. If God is good, why am I dying? If God is good, why do I have cancer? If God is good, and you are God's representative. So who is the lightning rod for that anger? That would be you. And I say to you, that is a sacred privilege. Take it for the Lord. Let them unload, because that's part of the process. You got to sort of verbalize and get that out there. Then sometimes comes the bargaining stage. Well, God, if you'll save me, or if you'll heal me, or if you'll heal my son, I will do these kind of things. Not uncommon, pretty much the way we're built, because we want any way around this. We're used to getting our ways by hook or by crook or by somehow, and if I pray harder, if I fast and pray, then God is obligated. But the fact is, God isn't obligated. God has already given us, in his Son and by his grace, exceedingly abundantly beyond what we could ask or think. So this stage you listen to, and I just want to familiarize you with it so that as people go through this, even the grieving sometimes have these sorts of stages. And it's not so you can be clever and say, oh, well, you're in the bargaining stage. Soon comes depression. That's not particularly helpful. But if you are insightful in these areas, then you will know how to come alongside someone. And this is the place where counselor really means presence of God. You are just there. You want to know exactly the right words to say when you come to somebody whose child has been killed in a wreck and you're there meeting them in the emergency room? I'll tell you, there isn't a correct thing to say. Plus, whatever you say is not memorable unless you say something really stupid and doesn't really minister to the need. But your presence does. Some of the very best things I said as a physician was nothing, because there was nothing to say. I just sat, held hand, and cried to weep with those that weep. There is no explanation. In my field of OB-GYN, is stillbirths, ectopic pregnancies, the kind of things where what starts out as a delightful, exciting experience that's supposed to end in a baby that makes everybody happy ends differently. And as you heard earlier, the funeral of an infant is very different than the funeral of a saint that's lived 85 years and served the Lord and has a whole litany of things they've done. There is different. This isn't the suffering Olympics. It's not to see who's suffered the most, but understand they are very distinct kinds of pain, and that's legitimate. There does come a time for most of acceptance, a recognition that, all right, it's my time, and that's okay. And the family sometimes can't handle that because they're ready to go. They've made their accounts square. They have done what they needed to do, and now they're ready to go. That's Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and her book on death and dying. I think it's a classic enough that you should have it. So from the standpoint of death and dying, and for the sake of time, obviously the conscious person we can interact with and get a sense for how they would like us to handle this life-threatening event. And hopefully in the discussion time, or perhaps even with Dr. Magnuson, we'll talk about what you ought to have, living wills, the power of attorney for healthcare, some way that you have legally put down to take the weight off of your loved ones as to how you would like things done if you can't make those decisions. That's huge. And I would also agree that if you were to jot down what you would like in your own funeral service, not only is it helpful for you to think through your mortality, but it is such a relief for them to know this is what he wanted. He wanted so-and-so to preach and so to sing, and he wanted this pastor. And so that service is like a gift and a tribute to you. It won't take you very long because you probably already have in your mind, I've already done it. I know who's preaching, know what they're preaching. I even know probably what they'll say. And that's okay. To me, that's a comfort. Not that I'm in a hurry, but, you know, there comes that time where death is imminent. And we still care for them, and we still encourage good symptom care and comfort care. But every human life is worthy of respect every moment that it's here. But I do believe there is a time that we have done all that we can do to prolong life, and there may be a time that we're just prolonging the dying process. because there is no opportunity to restore life and health. But still, respect is part of the picture. So now let's look at grief, because if you've not been through this process, my telling you about it is not going to be as helpful as I'd like, because you cannot understand how profound this pain is until you walk that valley. And if I can make you appreciate that, or make you a good student and observer for folks going through this pain, you will do well as a minister. I guarantee you, when you come to the end of your ministry career, 20, 30, 50 years, I hope, some of the most memorable moments when people talk about you will not be the glowing sermons you preached, but how you were there when they needed you, how you sat with them when Uncle Fred was dying, how you walked with them through the deepest valleys of their life. That, brothers and sisters, is ministry, in my opinion. It's just a huge and sacred opportunity. Grief is normal. God designed us that way. I took out the slide that has the tears and the grief in the scripture. It's there. Jesus, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. He wept appropriately. He had his bowels went out. He was compassionate towards those who were sick and to those who had died and the loved ones surrounding them. So understand that grief is a normal response to loss. We're going to talk about the loss of a loved one, but you can also grieve normally to fractured relationships and destroyed dreams. But as it turns out, the death of a loved one also impacts those, because that relationship, that rhythm of life that you had, is now gone. And that dream that you may have had with that loved one is now changed dramatically. So understand, this really cuts to the core of the being, and it rattles us in a way that nothing else does, because it comes face to face with the reality of the effects of the sin, original sin, that death is here. Now, death is an enemy, but it's a defeated enemy. So we don't have to be afraid of it, but I think we ought to appreciate it and then realize that the grief response that God designed is a really powerful one. Now, as a physician, having watched people die, prior anticipation, you know, the death that's coming, we saw this coming, it's a cancer, it's a process, we've treated it, it responded, we treated it again, it came back, now we're at the end stage. That separation is different, but it doesn't mean it's easy, all right? But the death where there's no anticipation, the car wreck, it can't be. I just talked to them this morning. That can't be. I just was on the phone with them 15 minutes ago. But the reality is, yes, that's a different kind of grief. There's no preparation, and it hits you like a wave, and it will unnerve you, and it may cut your pins out. The level of intimacy with the person may have, and usually has, direct relationship to the intensity of the grief. You know, if it's your great-great-uncle that you haven't seen in 10 years, you will grieve, but it won't be the same as someone who lives in your household that you see every day that dies suddenly. Clearly, one's faith system is huge in how they grieve, whether they grieve as those without hope or whether they grieve with a certain sense of security as to where that soul is. It makes all the difference in the world, and it will make a difference if, for those of you who will be preaching the services, because knowing that is a comfort that I can't begin to describe to you, to know that that loved one is with the Lord, that you will go one day, and in my opinion, you will both see and recognize that person, and the relationship will be different, but I think it will be different in a good way. Because that's the way I understand God and who he is and his relational aspect. Personality. Some folks tend to be withdrawn, introverted, and death can be tricky for them. They've never expressed emotion. We've got some guys here that they brag on the fact that they've never cried. Okay, good for you. Except God designed you as an emotional being. Then when you hit this time, you got no way to get it out. And all of those feelings are swirling inside you, and one of my personal things is hearing pastors brag about how they preached their fathers' or their wives' funerals. That's denial, folks. That is not understanding the grief process. Now, sure, say a eulogy, tell how much you love, but let somebody else deal with that and let you handle your grief. Because if you don't, it will explode on you later in a dramatic way that you won't enjoy. All right, enough of that sermon. But, you know, extroverts, folks that can weep and wail and cling to the casket, they heal much faster, because they are letting that grief happen, and they are expressing it, and it's exploding out of them, which it needs to do. Because if it doesn't get out, it causes stuff within. And it can be migraines, backaches, ulcers, it can be all sorts of things. Suicidal depression. So this is a big life crisis. The circumstances of death, obviously, if it's something noble, he was working hard and he had a heart attack in the pulpit while he was preaching. Well, that preaches pretty good, doesn't it? But some of those other kind of things, we don't talk about suicide victims. We don't talk about people that died from AIDS, even if they got AIDS from a blood transfusion. Well, everybody's going to think. And so even the circumstances of death can be problematic. And if you've not dealt with a family who's dealing with the suicide of a child or a relative, you got some problems. You really got to get in behind the scene and minister to them and love them in spite of the fact that this person has made a bad decision, clearly. But there's still some grief work that's going to need to be done. All right. Now, this is put here to let you know that grief affects everything. There's nothing about grief that's good for you. All right? It's an overwhelming sensation, and at the bottom line, it lowers your immune system, making you susceptible to everything. You are in a weakened state when you are grieving. And we're going to talk a little about the physical signs, and I think if you've got all these slides, I hope it will help you appreciate what folks are going through. Because if you don't understand that the depression, why would a Christian who lost a Christian loved one get so depressed that they're thinking about suicide? Does it make sense to you? This person who is part of my life has gone to be with the Lord. I desperately miss them. I desperately want to be with them. I don't see life without them. If I die, I go to be with the Lord too. You have to understand that while that doesn't seem rational to you, and it isn't, if you're grieving and you're not sleeping and eating and your immune system is down, you are not in position to make good decisions. And so bad decisions start to sound pretty good, which unfortunately happens to all of us from time to time. But in this grief time, it's so overwhelming that even suicide starts to look appealing. And we see an increase in rate, and we see particularly interesting statistics. Husbands, wives that have been married a long time, one spouse dies, other one dies not long after, in many cases. Within 6 months, the death rate last I checked, it was 4 or 5 times higher. So that's an opportunity for you to understand that's a crisis in that home. You can do a good funeral, but we're all too quick to say, well, everybody's gone home now, all the food's gone, it's been 2-3 weeks, you ought to be over it. Trust me, nobody's over it in 2 or 3 weeks. In fact, the denial and shock can last that long. So they are just facing the grief head on when all the family's gone and the pastoral and church visits are slowing down, and that may be the time of most critical need. Grief feels awful. I've given this lecture, but until my dad passed away, I didn't know what it was like to just not feel like you could breathe. Gasping and sighing, it just feel like there was gorillas on your chest and you just couldn't move, and then you didn't even want to. You just felt terrible. You couldn't talk. You just felt sick. You didn't feel like eating, which, of course, the Baptist response to everything is potluck dinner. Bring them food and make them eat. But in a normal grief response, your appetite's gone. You don't feel like eating. So I try to make sure they stay hydrated because they'll do fine with that and not force, the fried chicken dinner on somebody who's legitimately grieving. Now, others, they will eat the entire chicken while it's still moving. That's how they're handling their grief response. So you don't have to cubbyhole folks, but be understanding and don't try to force the issue. No muscle strength. You just feel like you can't get up, you can't go, you just can't move. It's powerful and overwhelming at times. The emotional symptoms. Now, shock, this is a different shock than you've lost all your blood on the floor and there's nothing circulating. This is a shock where you just, words are coming, but nothing's happening. When they diagnose, I'm a doctor. I'm an OB-GYN. When they diagnosed my wife with breast cancer, I could see the doctor's mouth moving, but after the word cancer came by, nothing was happening. My brain was mush, and it's a pretty good brain. I mean, it's fading a bit now, but there was a time it was quite sharp, and in that time, I was just nothing. It wasn't there. I was helpless. The shock and numb is describing what happens when a death, even if expected, you may have some of these kinds of feelings. And the denial part is that's a normal response. So let it happen. It can't be, I don't believe it, you got to be wrong, get a second opinion, let's call somebody, maybe it's the wrong person, let me identify all of those things, pretty normal. You have to be the calm, steadying influence that allows all that to flow out and then walk through it as many times as necessary until slowly the denial is broken down and the realization that this is reality. And reality sometimes isn't very pleasant. And you'll see people who, okay, I get it, I got it. It's terrible, it's awful, but I'm all right. And you ask people, how are you doing? I'm doing fine, coping well. How's she doing? Ah, oh, she's doing great. She's trusting the Lord, everything's looking good. I hope after today that runs up red flags in your head to say, uh-uh, that's probably not right, because the symptoms will erupt. And they'll erupt unexpectedly. They may get home to a familiar smell, a familiar room, an empty room, and bam, if there's not somebody there to hold them up, they may melt down on you. That's how these are powerful symptoms. And we're all designed this way. Yours may eke out in different ways. It doesn't have to be a major explosion. It may be a slow leak. But the symptoms will come out. And the memories. Immediately, someone will want to know, what was our last conversation? How did we part? And they will be racing to grasp those memories, to hang on to. So they don't lose the memories because they feel like that's losing the person. And there's an anxiety that's indescribable, because of fear of losing that person who's now died, and how is life going to look now? And memory is not really trustworthy, and particularly not in times of this kind of overwhelming grief. All right, we move along. Clearly, this normal process, life's rhythms are disrupted. They may have been disrupted for a while if there's been a lot of hospital kind of visits. But if it's an emergent, catastrophic crisis death, then all of a sudden you go from seeing regularly day-to-day kind of activity to gone. Really tough. Somatic distress, that just means the body things, all the stuff we talked about. Preoccupation with images. It is normal for them to see or think they see the deceased. A car that reminds them, boom, they think they see him. A person, same kind of body type, boom, and for a flash moment, they think they see him. It is normal, common, I won't say universal, but very common for people to have dreams and see that person again. Of course, if you've lived with them for 30 years, they are so inside your psyche. I don't think that's a bad thing. People ask me, well, did God send him to comfort me? I say, God can do anything. It's not my point if that gave a little hope and encouragement, I'm all right with that. Now, when they start talking to the deceased, believing they're there and hearing back from the deceased, then we've moved to what we call psychosis. And that's people that are fatigued. We could do that to you. If I kept you up for 3 days, you'd be seeing stuff that wasn't there and talking to people that aren't even there and probably getting some good advice from them. That's sort of our humanity, all right? So be kind and gracious, but what that probably means is they need a little help and encouragement. They need somebody to, and maybe rest is all they need. Guilt is huge. As I like to say, there is no situation so bad that a little guilt can't make it worse. And so people think, if I had said this, if I had done this, if I hadn't said this, if I hadn't done this, if I had known, then it would have changed. So the death is my fault. Well, I don't know why we want to do that, but we always do. I treated thousands of women in my GYN practice with miscarriages. Every one of them thought it was their fault. It's not. But someone needs to articulate that. Someone needs to invite that conversation, say, no, medically speaking, nothing you did, not the two Cokes that you had, or lifting the box over your head, or driving too fast down the highway, caused you to miscarry this child. Trust me, this is, it's a, in my field, obviously, a bigger deal than in many of yours, but at least 1 out of 3 pregnancies miscarry. There's a huge problem out there of folks that are grieving, and they don't know how to grieve, because nobody's allowing them to express their grief. The hostile reactions I've mentioned, and as ministers, you're going to get them. And I suggest you take them. And if there's a family squabble, get in the middle of it and deflect the heat. Because some want the organ and some want guitars, and all that stuff about funeral preparation can cause a rift. That may be a time for you to take the blame and just jump in there and say, well, let's do it this way this time, and do the best you can as you were told to accommodate. But sometimes you'll be asked to do things that are just, okay, impossible. You really can't honor the Lord with. But I've done some things that would stretch your minds, because I thought, okay, that's at least in the gray zone. It's amazing the way some people grieve, but it's not my job to force on them how I would do it. This is the abnormal thing. This is what to look for. And I kind of mentioned that psychosis part when they're not only seeing images, but they see them and they're sitting at the table talking to the deceased. That's probably a problem. I'm fine, all's well. Be aware of that. If this is somebody you've been married to for 30 years and they've just passed away, You don't get over it that fast. There's a grieving process. How long do you guess the normal grieving process for a spouse that's been married over 10 years? 6 weeks? Yeah, at least a year. At least is normal. Now, that doesn't mean they're incapacitated for a year. There should be a progression. But still, the memories, the tears, the ache can come back like that for a year, and I'd say even up to two. We'll talk about a few things that would scare me. Enshrinement, that is the person's room, their clothes, everything is exactly as it was. Now, wrong is at the funeral to send somebody back to clear out all their stuff. That's wrong. Allow some time to separate, but when that becomes the holy shrine that nobody goes into or you talk very quietly, for the first few weeks and even months, I'm okay with that. But when you get out to a year or two, then we're probably in what I would consider abnormal. The obsessing over the loss at the beginning is absolutely normal. But over the course of time, there should return some normal functions, some normal thinking processes. Depression is going to happen. It's common to feel blue, to feel low, to feel sad. Of course, that's part of the grief process. But we should grow and learn to come through that. And we're talking weeks, months, not days. What would I recommend? And you've heard some of this, so I'll just highlight this and leave any questions you have for me for later. Your presence is huge. Show up. Sometimes showing up is all you can do, and sometimes it's the best thing that you can do. I am an advocate sometimes for short-term medication for sleep. And the reason is, if you don't sleep for 4 days, you're not going to get any better. So I will give such a small prescription that if they took it all at once with a whole bottle of whiskey, it won't kill them, all right? But it'll give them a couple of nights sleep. And night times are scary for those that are grieving. They're scary. They may have never been in the house alone. Every sound, everything is reminding. They close their eyes and they see the deceased. And they can't sleep because their minds are a whirl. And after a while, that will take you down physically. I don't think everybody needs it. I've written a lot of scripts that they gave back to me because they didn't need it, which is fine. And I don't even write them unless somebody asks. But I don't feel like that's necessarily copping out, because the stuff I use gets about 4 hours of rest. And that's at least enough to break the cycle. But that's my personal opinion. Others can certainly argue that. The funeral-making decisions, I never did it when I went to the hospital at the time of the death. I would then schedule an appointment for the next day. But, you know, sometimes you don't get to do that at all. As I said, you may walk into the funeral home and you're the only guy there that has a Bible. You are the preacher. Anniversary dates, and I emphasize this because I had no idea how important it is. Figure out a way on your computer or on your day timer to put down the date of death. And that date, let's say the 10th, for the first couple of months, either send a card or make a phone call. And certainly on the anniversary, either make a call or send a card. It will be huge. It's good discipline for you, and it is awesome not only to honor the deceased, but to encourage and comfort the survivors. It's a simple thing to do, but it's really important. I didn't know why the 9th of every month for the first 6 months after Dad's death, I got depressed for no, I didn't know why. Then it dawned on me, and I realized now it's been years, and that's not the issue anymore. But it's pretty easy to connect back with the grief because it's your mom or your dad. I mean, that's pretty normal. That's just a reflection of love. Early contact, the funeral planning visit, funeral. We talked some about the funeral stuff. And I would urge you that the 6 weeks after the death, it's not over. Now, people that have a great family support system, they may not need you, like those who don't have a family support system. And so there is a different role that you that are in pastoral ministry will take for the first year or two even after a death. And then you will withdraw back to the other kind of distance, the normal distance. This is one of those, star it, underline it. Loneliness is still a major problem for most at 1 year. Okay? That's most. So that's not abnormal. And this is my suggestion, that the repression of emotional expression that we sometimes hang on people to just, you know, you're a man, men don't cry, be strong. Or my personal favorite, well, I've got to be strong for the family. That is denial. Okay, that's all wrapped up in very glorious terms. I'm not even going to check in and look at my feelings. I'm going to take care of everybody else. Okay, you can do that for a while, but then what happens is everybody else is taken care of, everybody else goes home, and it's all still there for you. And it's brand new and it's fresh, and you got nobody around to help you. So be on the lookout for those. The other thing is, I think it's on this next slide. Nope, not quite. Yeah, grieving people are not looking for instant answers. Oh, Dr. Bill, why did Uncle Fred die? Well, 20 years of smoking, lung cancer. They don't want to hear that. Because that's not what they want. What they want is their loved one back. And your answer to the medical reasons as to why they died, it's not pertinent. I don't know. Clearly, God is sovereign and in control, and God loves you, and you move from there. But trust me, what they really don't want is the answer to that question. What they want is for the situation to not be so. They need reassurance, your presence, and hope. This is really the significance of the role of the minister. And for pastor, for chaplain, for counselors at times, presence of God in symbol. You are there representing the Lord Jesus Christ. So you may take some anger, but you will also have that blessed opportunity to share what the meaning of life and death is. And I would agree with the concept of keep your messages short, but they can be clear. They can be compassionate. They can be God-honoring and give you an opportunity for them to see the man, the woman of God, depending on how the services all work, but your presence there in a very powerful way that is winsome, and see that you do genuinely care, and that what you believe is strong and brings hope. And then there may be opportunities later, often opportunities driving to and from funerals, from grave sites that are distant, to have some very meaningful conversations. This is one of those times that they expect you to come, and so take that opportunity to be present, to go there. I don't think if they have, you know, casket visitation for 6 hours, which, by the way, I would vote strongly against. You know, a couple hours is all anybody really needs to stand, a couple or three. But I would always be there before so that the family came, and I would be there to meet them, to greet them, to walk them by for the first time. If you can't, the funeral directors are skilled at this. Get to know them and take advantage of their giftedness. But then once the family started rolling in, I might depart. I don't think you have to be there for the entire time, but you work that out for yourself. Respect in all cases, not only for the deceased, but for the survivors, and the relationship that you have with them as pastor or counselor can be something that that this time builds on. All right, my time is ebbing to a close here, so let me put this one on there because I do want you to think family of the deceased, because what will happen is the people that are quiet, you will neglect. And that's often the children. And the children have no mechanism of coping with death. And they're sitting quietly coloring or playing, and you're thinking, well, they're quiet, that's all right. What they're thinking is they did something, and it's their fault. You got to get on the floor. And that's actually one of my favorite parts. Just sit down with them, color if you need to, chat a little bit, see how they're doing, and make it clear to them that Uncle Fred died because of this. It wasn't your fault, with the Lord. However old the child is, let them know that you minister to them. And I guarantee you that the spouse that you left behind for a few minutes to go talk to the child is feeling that you genuinely care about the whole family. So keep your eyes open to the ones that are getting lost in the background. Now, I never had the situation with the girlfriend and the wife deal, and I'm grateful for that. I'm not sure how I'd have handled it, but there are some complicating issues, and while we can bless you and encourage you, you will have to think on the fly sometimes. Community resources. Know what's available. Some of the funeral homes in Texas, I also was popular because I would come, if there was someone who didn't have a pastor, I'd come and do the ceremony for them. So they had me set up with a gift certificate, and they said they would replace it each time for a burial site for free if I had somebody that couldn't afford one. Well, that's really nice. Obviously, they wanted me to send them business, and it's a business. No problem with that, because if they do their business well, I think they allow me to minister the way I do better. So there's no problem with that, but it can be a very mutually positive relationship. Encourage expression. Hopefully you've got that from me. It is okay to cry. It is okay to wail. It is okay to scream. It's okay to pound if that's what you need to do to start getting it out. I would send people to the Psalms, because the psalmist has some great wailing, yelling at God Psalms to give you the inspired version of how to talk to God when you're really chapped. As opposed to, well, I can't talk to God now, I'm just too angry. As if God doesn't get that. As if God doesn't know. So we can free people to say, that's how you feel. Be honest. Let's go to God together and you just say whatever you need to. Or if you can't speak, let me pray for you and I will take you to the throne of grace. That is a huge, huge opportunity. Offer to pray. Only time anyone's turned me down was a fellow that was so intoxicated, I'm not sure he would have heard me anyway. But I always ask. We'll skip that. We'll skip that, and we'll go to that one. Because this can be, I think, quite helpful. To free the person to think about what happened, to get those thoughts, and then to write them down. I can't tell you how important it was for me, because I was afraid I'd forget how my dad did this, how my dad did that, where his tattoo was. He got tattooed was in the service. Well, I was having anxiety over forgetting those things. Well, just write them down. Put them in my journal, and for me, that was very helpful. For those that are verbal, they will talk it through. And let me just warn you, you're going to hear the death story a dozen times. And that's quite fine. When they want to tell you about, oh, and how this and this happened, and then he did this, and the doctor did this, and the doctor said that, and you're going to say, yeah, that's pretty much the way you told it the last four or five times. You honor the deceased. It is a sacred moment. You are helping their healing process. So listen again, and listen with compassionate ears as if it was the first time. Because the way their mind is working, for them that may seem like it's the first time. And in telling it, there's healing. So grant them that freedom. It's okay to weep. I had a patient that I diagnosed with breast cancer in her 30s. We treated her. It didn't work. She was a member of the church. I love this woman, as did the church. When we had her funeral service, our pastor gave an eloquent message, but he was very detached. I mean, it was a lovely message, but it didn't connect. Our associate pastor at the time, Danny Aiken, and some of you may know him because he's now the president of Southeastern Seminary, he came up to give the message, and he didn't lose control, but you could tell that he loved this woman and cared. He's the one that connected. He's the one we wanted to hear because he loved her and it showed. So if you know this person and you've been close to him, it's okay. It's not a sign of weakness. Now, I don't mean that you weep uncontrollably so you can't speak, but let it be known. It's all right for your humanity to show. And I guess that will be my final plea. So I will turn it over to Dr. Magnuson, and we'll have a chance to do Q&A in a bit.